Emmanuel Macron's en marche hold power in France. The far-right AfD is challenging Angela Merkel's uninterrupted grip on power in Germany. And Greece's radical left-wing group, Syriza, is the largest party in the Hellenic Parliament. In fact, new movements have done pretty well of late. But what's behind their rise? And what happens when the anti-establishment goes mainstream? I'm Rhys James, and I've been attempting to find out. Here's a reminder of some of that success.
President Emmanuel Macron is hoping a big win will give him what he needs to push his agenda forward.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you see signs that say hate is no alternative for Germany, of course, playing on the party name.
Dare to dream. The dawn is breaking on an independent, united kingdom.
We do know that this party, the Alternative for Germany, does have several sort of different kind of strains. It was originally founded as a party of Euroskeptics. So really, antagonism towards the Euro was really one of its main
parliament
points.
By November, he announced that he was making a run for the French presidency, claiming to represent a third way. Those some had said it could not be done, but Emmanuel Macron has now been elected president of France with neither experience of elected office nor any established political party behind him.
And let's get rid of the flag, the anthem, Brussels and all that has gone wrong.
That was UKIP's former leader celebrating Britain's vote to leave the EU. We also heard about Emmanuel Macron's victory with En Marche and the AfD's big gains in Germany's federal elections. So how difficult is it for a new party to get off the ground and challenge their bigger rivals? I've been speaking to Professor Tim Bale, who teaches politics at Queen Mary University of London.
I think it's a lot easier than perhaps it was. Social media, the desperation of the mainstream media to sell space and airtime by making their political coverage sexier and more adversarial and more celebrity-centred, plus the possibilities offered nowadays by crowdfunding, I think, all mean that there's more oxygen, if you like, for new parties to breathe than there used to be. And I think another thing that makes a difference is the inexorable decline of tribal loyalties among voters, you know, whether those loyalties were rooted in class or religion or in the adherence to big ideas like socialism. Far fewer voters than used to be the case describe themselves as identifying strongly with one political party or other these days. So that means that more of those voters are up for grabs, as it were.
Newer parties often don't appear to be as slick as their bigger rivals. Do you think that's part of their appeal, the fact that they don't have that slickness?
You need to think of them as startups, I guess. I mean, they may have a great idea, they may even have an inspirational leader, but they still need funding, for example. And that's not always easy, even where parties are given money by the state, because that money is often distributed, at least in part, according to votes that the party got at the last election and the number of members they've got, which doesn't really help new parties very much. Those parties also need infrastructure, whether that's physical infrastructure or in terms of human resources. And they need a commonly understood way, an agreed way of going about things internally. And that takes time to build. And there may well be arguments about it, particularly over, you know, who's in charge of what. New parties, which are populist parties anyway, those parties that claim to speak as outsiders for the people against a mainstream elite, are at a bit of an advantage if they and their leaders are seen as authentic, as speaking their minds, as not caring about political correctness, as saying what everyone else is supposedly thinking. Of course, a lot of that authenticity is anything but. However, as the saying goes, you know, sincerity, if you can fake that, you've got it made. Sometimes the new parties are pretty good at faking it. Very many of the small parties that we've seen come through in Europe come from the sort of extremes of left and right. The interesting thing about Emmanuel Macron and En Marche is that he represents, or at least he claims to represent, a populism of the centre, if you like, rather than of the far right, like the AfD, or the far left, like Syriza in Greece or Podemos in Spain. And I guess that might mean that the pattern, if you like, that we've seen over the last few decades, you know, the pattern being that the new parties are radical parties with quite simplistic ideological worldviews, is beginning to break up. And that would leave us with a rather wider ecology of newcomers, which, of course, for some new parties is a good thing. But for those new parties who, as it were, have as part of their brand the fact that they're, you know, very right wing or very left wing, this kind of centrist populism might be a bit of a problem.
That was Professor Tim Bale. We're going to take a closer look now at the AfD in Germany. The success of the far-right party in the country's federal elections sent shockwaves through the political establishment. They won 13% of the vote. To To put that into some sort of context, they outperformed everyone except the Conservatives and the Social Democrats. So why did they do so well? I've been speaking to Stephanie Boltson from Die Welt.
It was mainly one very known decision, which was the decision by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel back in the summer of 2015 to open the German borders and to let in more than around 1 million refugees, mainly from Syria, but also many people from beyond the war zone. So people from Asia, people from Africa. And that, of course, has had an amazing impact on Germany, taking in so many people in so little time. And quite a lot of people were not happy with that decision. And I think the vote now back in September was an expression of this discontent. All the statistic and analysis done after the federal elections show that mainly the supporters of the AfD come from East Germany. Germany was divided until 1989. So you had West Germany and East Germany. East Germany was the communist part. And while 25 years and more onwards, inequality between East and West has been very much diminished, and many parts of East Germany are flourishing, like Dresden or Leipzig, East Berlin, of course, and Berlin have merged. But there are still quite a lot of pockets that are very poor. There's high unemployment. There's a lot of people who are not happy with their lives. They might be okay off. They have an income, they have work, but they feel very much threatened in their identity. They feel they have lost once their origin, which when the wall came down, everything changed. And some people have not managed to transition into a capitalist system. And they are very resentful of everything that's going on around them. The fact is also that people in East Germany who actually voted for the AfD have very little or no contact at all with refugees, because they come from an area where actually no refugees have been accommodated. So it has been an expression of discontent of these people who feel politics is done for the others, but never for themselves. In the use of social media, if you look at where AfD voters actually get their information from, they do not get it from the, say, conventional or traditional print media or online media. They get it mainly or exclusively from Facebook. They are in certain Facebook groups. The AfD by far has most followers. They have double or three or four times more followers on Facebook and on Twitter than the traditional parties like the CDU, Angela Merkel's CDU, or the Social Democrats. So the AfD has been very successfully, and so has Donald Trump in the US, and so has the Brexit supporters in the UK, have mobilized this part of society and the part of the electorate that used this election in Germany and the EU referendum back in 2016 in the UK to express their discontent with what is currently going on in their country.
I'm going to ask you now if you can get your crystal ball out and kind of cast ahead, maybe a year or a couple of years down the line. What do you think will happen to the AfD?
I think what is very important for German politics, for German parties, is not to be complacent. No one can say if the AfD is still there. It might be gone by then because what we mentioned before, because of internal disputes. But one thing is clear. Germany, as in other countries, in Italy, in France, in the UK, in Spain, wherever you look, especially in Poland and especially in Eastern Europe, the political landscape is moving to the right. And Germany has just now followed suit. So the political spectrum has moved to the right. Whether in 4 years' time it's an AfD or it's a new party or another one, but with all the changes in our continent, in Europe, of globalization, refugee crisis, politics is moving more to the right. So whether with the AfD or another party, that's to be seen.
That was Die Welt's Stephanie Boltson. If there's one new party that has outshone the success of the AfD in Germany, it's Macron's En Marche. The party didn't even exist 18 months ago, but now they hold power in France. So what should we know about it? Here's Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson.
En Marche is an extremely new arrival on the French political scene, and its actual birth was announced by the now President Emmanuel Macron back in early 2016 in April. And that just gave him a 13 or so month lead time ahead of the presidential elections to establish that party, get it up and running, and use that as the vehicle as well as the slogan, which of course brought him to power. And Don't forget that the E and the M of En Marche also represent the initials of Emmanuel Macron. So it was a fairly brilliant piece of marketing and a well-established machine that few expected to perform anything like how it did end up performing. But, you know, Macron had a very short-lived political career, 2 years or so in the government of President Hollande, holding a fairly junior ministerial position. And he then broke away and decided to form his own party, which he thought was necessary given the state of the French political landscape, but also in terms of sweeping him to power and making him the youngest president this country has ever seen, which the existing political machinery probably wouldn't have been able to, because there were clearly bottlenecks, just as there are in established parties in other parts of Europe. La République En Marche, as it has been known ever since the election, is a political movement which is centrist and liberal. It positions itself as being pro-European and progressive. So it appeals to a lot of people who, let's say, were to the left of centre, to the right of centre, and in the centre. And that's a very attractive place to be positioned, especially given the scandals that existed in the ranks of the centre-right during the campaign. François Fillon, who at one stage was thought to be the president-in-waiting, who was championing the centre-right Les Républicains party, he was embroiled in a scandal. Then, of course, you had the centre-left, the Socialist Party, the mainstream left in France, which had been in office for 5 years. President Hollande had done, by most people's standards, a pretty disastrous job, and his approval rating was only 4 or 5%, according to some polls, by the time he left office. So this was very ripe ground for the picking. La République En Marche has had candidates in constituencies right up and down the country in the subsequent parliamentary elections, and has done extremely well, as we've seen, securing an absolute majority in the National Assembly. So all of this is a remarkable turn of events for a party that's barely 18 months old.
Do you think that the amateurish nature of the party could be a problem going forward? Do you envisage that there could be problems that En Marche might face?
Emmanuel Macron has got extremely bold ambitions, which include slashing the budgets of local governments by about 13 billion euros, making cuts to the expense on defence, expense on education, and so on. And this is going to be extremely unpopular with the French public, not to mention his labour reforms. And I think the next big setback for President Macron has been the Senate elections, in which La République En Marche only managed to produce some 24 senators, which was, again, a major blow to Emmanuel Macron, not from a working point of view, in that, you know, the Senate doesn't have the ability to have a final say on legislation, but it does have the power to delay bills and it can hold things up. And it wasn't a very good showing there for Emmanuel Macron and his En Marche movement. So it's not been without its ups and downs, and certainly the last month or two will have given President Macron plenty to think about.
That was Tom Burgess-Watson in Paris. And to conclude the programme, we're off to the Balkans. The region is a hotbed of emerging political talent. Here's our correspondent there, Guy Delaunay.
Slovenia seems like a sensible kind of place. The capital, Ljubljana, is postcard pretty. Cyclists and pedestrians rule the roads of the old town, and there's a general air of prosperity. In short, you wouldn't think that people here would vote in a party so new that it didn't even exist until a few weeks before the last general election. But 3 years ago, that's exactly what they did. Miro Cerar was a respected academic and political commentator. He was one of the authors of Slovenia's constitution. Nothing about his appearance, all rimless glasses and conservatively cut suits, suggested that he might be the type to turn the country's political scene upside down. Then, 6 weeks before the election, he announced his intention to enter politics. The hastily assembled project went by a quickly chosen name, the Miro Cerar Party. The law professor was staking everything on his good name. The cost of failure would have been considerable. But Serar's timing was impeccable. The euphoria of independence had long since dissipated. The global financial crisis hit Slovenia hard. Its state-owned industries were wobbling and banks teetering on the brink of collapse. One former prime minister was jailed for corruption. The public judged his successors wanting in their efforts to put the country back on track. Miro Cerar told me the snap election was a now-or-never moment.
There are people in Slovenia who are capable of do something better, who could make some change for our society, and I wanted to be part of that group. And we were really persuasive, obviously, because we won the elections with a historic result, gained 36 seats in the parliament out of 90, and so we formed the government and started to work.
South of the border, Croatia has also been dabbling in new political parties. Its voters faced a grim choice 2 years ago, the right-wing nationalist HDZ, or a social democratic party which governed through 6 consecutive years of recession. Faced with that selection, many voters plumped for none of the above. The main beneficiaries were MOST, a Croatian acronym for the Bridge of Independent Lists. Its leader, Božo Petrov, was a young, small-town mayor with a reputation for cutting the fat and graft from local government. MOST promised to do the same on a national basis. They joined with the HDZ in a government which initially looked awfully like bad business as usual, but it barely lasted 6 months before MOST lived up to its anti-corruption pledges. They effectively brought down the government after the HDZ's leader became embroiled in graft allegations. There were fresh elections, and once again, MOST teamed up with the HDZ to form a government. But the most successful new party of the lot has to be Serbia's Progressive Party. They've been in power since 2012, winning 3 parliamentary elections and 2 presidential votes. It's either one of the most successful rebranding exercises of all time, or, for the Progressives' critics, one of the greatest cons. The Progressives formed just 9 years ago, breaking away from the ultra-nationalist, ultra-nasty Radical Party. Their leaders, Tomislav Nikolic and Aleksandar Vučić, had both served in government during the era of Slobodan Milošević. But they declared they'd changed. They were renouncing nationalism and focusing on Serbia becoming a member of the European Union. At the same time, they would clamp down on the cronyism which had swallowed up the high hopes for the country's new democratic era. The message worked a treat. By the end of 2012, Nikolic was president and his younger colleague was leading the government. And Aleksandar Vučić told me he was sincere about changing his ways.
To be very honest, I was not ashamed to confess all my political mistakes. And after all, after 1999, we saw the results of our politics. The result was very bad in all social spheres. We had as many ruined buildings, bridges, and all the other things in this country as you cannot imagine. We needed to change our aims. We needed to change unsuccessful and harmful politics.
Other new parties in the region haven't quite broken through. Rival factions of the former Kosovo Liberation Army set aside their differences to keep the self-determination movement out of government. And in Bosnia, the People's Plenum movement, which formed in the wake of riots 3 years ago, fizzled out after briefly threatening to overturn entrenched ethno-political interests. But because the history of Balkan democracy is so short, it always feels like nothing is set in stone. And that means new movements are likely to flourish for some years to come. For Monocle in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delorno.
Thanks very much, Guy. And if you've enjoyed this programme on new political parties, then don't forget to tune into The Globalist here on Monocle 24 every weekday. Here, Monocle's editors and correspondents share their unique perspective on global affairs, business, culture, and much more. I'm Rhys James. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.